How is everybody doing?
I give this day 2 thumbs up.
Hang in there, thank you.
Yeah, we all got a little bit of a long weekend, which was nice.
Happy Easter.
Yeah, happy Easter, guys. How's everybody else's classes going? Are they like running smoothly? Are your professors being nice?
Seems all right.
Boring.
Yeah, it is boring to never leave the house. I agree. Although I do sometimes leave the house and go for walks because it's been really nice. Okay. So by now, hopefully you guys have at least all maybe looked through your Attack Lab handout or downloaded that stuff. So that is going to be due on May 1st, just before midnight. So you've got a little while. What is today? The 13th? Yeah. So you've got a little while. This shouldn't take very long. And we're, I think, getting close to wrapping up our like lecture stuff in general. I want to say that let me see. Yeah, we're getting close. We're getting close to like being done with new stuff and then just doing some review stuff. And we're still kind of figuring out how we're going to do our final. So it might be different than we've done the final in the past. But we're trying to figure out right now like what will work for you guys and what works for us. And so I'm not going to talk anymore about it until we have something figured out, because I feel like I keep telling you like, oh, well, this won't be in the final or this will be on the final. But it might end up being like a whole different format of something that we haven't done before. So we'll talk about that when it gets closer. And in the meantime, we've got Attack Lab, which as we've gone over before, shouldn't be like a huge time suck for you any more than like maybe Bomb Lab was. So it's still gonna, it's still a little bit involved. It's still gonna take some effort and some time, but it's not gonna be like a shell lab or I think even like a data lab type of pulling you away from your other stuff. So if you've looked at it at all, you know that we're back to GDB and we're back to kind of like this attack oriented, in that we're trying to get the program to do something that it doesn't want to do or isn't meant to do. So we're kind of hacking this program is really what the assignment is. And this is another one where we don't have, is it the 20th, David? Cause I thought the first was pretty far away. Did that just not get changed?
It is the 20th. Like I just checked.
Okay. Okay, cool. Thank you. I was like, that's really far. It shouldn't take that long. This is more like it. Like you guys should be wrapped up with this and then we'll start final stuff. I guess that's next week. Like I said, this should not take you too terribly long. This is like a recovery lab. Not easy, but easier than shell lab. So this is similar to Bomb Lab in that we have a scoreboard again. We do have kind of a hand in. It's not anything like bananas. You're going to turn in your text file that has like your solutions to each phase on it. And each of the solutions is going to be, it's going to look like just like hexadecimal numbers. And so you have to kind of explain to us like why it works, like what it's doing. And that can just be comments. And it's that same kind of thing. Like, just let us know that you know what's happening here and that you didn't just like, you know, pull stuff from somewhere else or use somebody else's, even though like Bomb Lab, there are different versions of this lab that go out. So you likely don't have the same one as one of your classmates or as many of your classmates. We don't have any point penalties for this one. So you can just like go at it. You don't have to be worried about like losing points and having to restart. So that's also kind of nice. The first three phases are going to be buffer overflow, which we'll talk about a little bit today. And the second two phases are going to be some return, like some code injection stuff. So a little bit of like return oriented programming. What else do we have on this guy? Okay, so there's a little bit more info about that hand-in, and you'll submit that via Autolab as always. And once you submit your text file, Autolab will run that and your score should show up on the scoreboard. So every time you solve a phase, you'll have to like resubmit that for the scoreboard to update. And then make sure you have the solutions for your final score. Okay, I think that's everything about TACLAB. Does anybody have any questions about TACLAB or have started or have any comments? We also have this like bot, again, I don't know if you guys looked at this at all for Bomb Lab, but I don't even think I have, let's see. Okay, yeah, so you guys can if you're still in that bot channel from Bomb Lab, that will update us whenever anybody diffuses a phase. So that should also be updating. And I do think that's the end of that. Is there anything that I missed about Attack Lab, Saroj or David, that you think is important to go over? I think that's everything that you need to know.
Thank you.
Cool. If you haven't started yet, and we're still going over some of the concepts that are going to be really helpful for you for this lab in class. So if you're just following along with class and you haven't done the chapter reading yet, you might not quite be at the point where you would be able to get through the Attack Lab stuff on your own, but we're getting there. I encourage maybe reading ahead a little bit and going for reading, at the very least, like read through the handout, download everything and get used to getting back into GDB and running stuff. I think that when we did the demo, we have, you know, I think most people are gonna be using SSH now. You can definitely still use Guacamole, but it's a little bit laggier, a little bit slower. So I think SSH is the way to go with this last lab. If you have questions about that, just come to office hours. Okay, let me go ahead and adjust my screen so I can see this slide. Okay, so let's just as kind of a little bit of review, remember for our like intents and purposes as like programmers, we can think of our memory just as like this big array of bytes, right? So we've got different things that go in different places in that memory, and you know, each process has its own memory and each procedure is going to have its own like stack frame. We went over that kind of stuff, and we went over a little bit of like the calling convention stuff. I maybe should review that a little bit after we get through these slides, about the caller and the callee procedures. If you remember, if we're looking at this little diagram on the side, we have this, the way that our stack grows is downward, right? Like we're going to decrement from the stack to increase the size, actually, which is weird. Decrement from RSP, sorry. And so we have this caller frame higher up in memory, higher up in the stack. I mean, technically, it's actually lower in the stack. If we're talking about the top, talking about the stack gets weird, right? Because the diagram is weird and the way that we talk about it is kind of like makes it counterintuitive to what we're looking at. So the top of the stack is where RSP is. Lower in the stack is where older things that got pushed on the stack are, but they're higher in memory. So if I say something that's kind of funky, it's probably because I'm trying to rectify all that stuff. And if I say something and it doesn't make sense, please like raise your hand and I will try to clarify what I actually mean. So if we look at that caller frame, we have this older procedure that is going to call some other procedure, and we have over there any arguments. If there were, you know, six arguments, they'll go into those registers, or sorry, seven, if they're greater than seven, they'll get pushed onto the stack. We also, of course, are going to push our return address onto the stack. If we're using a base pointer, we're going to push that old base pointer onto the stack so we can restore that whenever we return as well. And then we're going to have stuff from the newer procedure that gets pushed on there as well. So we also went over a little bit of how recursion works, just in that, you know, even whenever a function calls itself, it's going to have its own stack frame. So the same way that, like, even if the same program is running, like, you know, more than one time, that's each its separate process. This is the same thing. Each time a function gets called, it's going to have its own stack frame that keeps track of its own, like, state and its own variables. Any questions about this so far?
What is argument build?
So that is going to be, that is from the last slide set.
That's fine. I'll look at the last slide set because I missed some of that class.
I mean, I'm happy to re-look over that because off the top of my head, I know it went over like really towards the end of what we were doing. We'll come back to that. Don't let me forget that because I do want to go over that because I feel like we had to go kind of fast through that last bit of stuff and I don't want that to be the case. So we'll come back to what exactly argument build means. I know that some of these like registers and local variables are from like the callee function. You know, we kind of went over that there are registers that are saved by the caller function and registers that are saved by the callee function. So you've got those on both sides. But for now, we'll move on. We'll come back to that. Okay. So this should look familiar. Like I said, we've got this like memory layout, this basically array of bytes for our purposes. So we have our stack right here. Basically, our runtime stack has this limit of 8 megabytes. So if you try to read outside of that limit with like RSP, that's one of the cases where you're going to get a segmentation fault. And that is, we've kind of talked about some of the stuff that gets stored on the stack. Certainly local variables goes on there, registered data, stuff like that. And then we haven't talked too much about the heap, right? So we also have this other memory structure called the heap that is dynamically allocated as we need it. And that happens anytime we call malloc. And then we have data, which is gonna be anything like global variables, any kind of like data that's like statically allocated at the beginning. And then we've got these shared library functions there. So those are things like where the malloc call is or where any kind of like C library stuff is, any of that like print, you know, the basic like library calls that we do. And then we have our text, which is going to be where like our executable code from our function goes. And that is a read-only function or a read-only portion of memory. Okay, so we've got this little example here, which is like really useful just to see like where things get stored. So if we take a look at what we've got decently sized. We've got one pretty big array and one really big array. We've got a global variable. Those global variables there, those arrays that get statically allocated there or assigned allocated. We have inside main a couple of pointers that we will use malloc to allocate space for. And
I have a question.
Yes.
Do the data and text segments and heap and all that stuff for x86-64 start at like a particular address, or is it different every time?
Yeah, so this is actually the text certainly does. The text is this is the convention for x86-64 is this 400000, right? And then this is the convention also for like our stack base there too.
Okay, cool.
Everything else is not, I don't believe is consistent. So I think the other stuff can change depending on the exact nature of the procedure.
Okay, and is there also a global variable pointer as well somewhere in there? That I guess x86-64?
I actually don't know. Does David or Sarosh, you know that? A global variable pointer.
Yeah, like a register in x86-64 that points to, I guess, the middle of like the portion where all the global variables are.
I don't. But I don't know. I don't believe so, but there must be like pointers, you know, to be able to access that that data. That is the Matt question, I think. Unless one of the TAs knows more on that than I do. But we can certainly ask him. Okay, so the kind of the value of this slide is to see where things get stored in this like memory diagram. So we have some stuff that gets allocated in this procedure, and then we can kind of see where this is. So we've got our stack, we know that our local variables are going to go on our stack. So we've got local variable going to that address that is certainly on the stack somewhere. You can see that our heap actually grows in both directions. So there's heap up top and there's heap down below, and it grows downwards and it grows upwards. And I actually don't know why this happens. I have never asked, and I'm not even sure if Matt would know. I'm sure Matt would probably looked into that. He's curious about stuff like that, but I don't know why this is. It just is. You also have, if you look at that heap, a bunch of space in the middle that's unallocated. If you were to try to access that space because there's just nothing there right now, that would also cause a segmentation fault. Just, you know, for your information. And then we've got our global variables that are going to go into that to that data section, and then we have our actual like executable stuff that ends up in text.
Yeah, I thought that it grew downward and upward so that like you, like I guess maybe the instruction, or at least in MIPS, the instruction can only like access a certain amount of space. So you could either subtract or add from it to access more space, or to access more information. Or at least I think that's the way it's set up in MIPS, and that's what I was talking about with this like global pointer.
Okay. So maybe I just don't know about that. I'm not sure. I would be curious to know actually the answer to that. So that is like a thing I would be happy to ask Matt about if he knows that, because the other stuff I've looked into, I haven't seen an answer to that anywhere. And I don't remember much MIPS. So that could be why. Okay. So now we're going to start talking about the stuff that's like, we've talked about some of the structural stuff that is going to help you understand Attack Lab. We're going to go into some of the stuff that you're actually going to be doing and how we are able to take this Attack Lab program and kind of make it do things that it's not meant to do. So we didn't go over this dynamically in class last time, but this is just a little example of, we did go over one with strings, that little password checker that we did. And this is a similar example to that with floats. So you can see we've got this array that gets defined as just an array with two indices. And we've got a couple of doubles. SD is our assigned double. And then we have this function that allows us to pass in an index, and it doesn't check the bounds of that index. So although our array is only two indices large, we could try and retrieve data. We could try to access other indices and assign them some value, right? So this is actually on our systems lab. So if you want to play with it, this is where it lives in on the server. You can go and mess with it right now. You can go mess with it, you know, at some point. But we'll also kind of tell you what happens with different eyes. So if you were to pass in 0 or 1, nothing's going to happen to that double, that local variable that gets assigned. It's just going to return 3.14. You can see that if we start to move outside of the bounds of that array, if we pass in a 2, it kind of starts to corrupt that data, right? So it changes it a little bit there, and if we pass in 3, it changes it a lot. And then weirdly enough, when we pass in 4, nothing happens to it. And then when we pass in 6 is when we get a segmentation fault. We've gone beyond the bounds of our stack at that point. And it actually worked. If you didn't come to my class the other day, or you watched Matt's for some reason, you saw him go through this dynamically. It may not be exactly like this because it's kind of system specific. I think we only got to like 3 or 4 before the segmentation fault, maybe 5. So it just depends on what you're running it on. Okay, so we can see a little bit of how this works. We've got these local variables on the stack, these two array indices, and then we've got these doubles. The compiler, whenever it creates a stack for a function or procedure, it will generally create extra room as well. So there is a little bit of space there. So even if there's just this one other variable, you may not cause a segmentation fault just by going a little bit beyond it, right? Because there's a little bit of extra space generally in the stack. And we'll see a little bit of that next. Okay, so this, as well as what we did last time with the password string, these are both examples of buffer overflow, right? So I think that we're gonna start talking about why this is happening, but let's go over that first. Okay, so this is a big deal. This is the number one cause of the number one technical cause of security vulnerabilities. So it's still a big deal. People are still writing code with these vulnerabilities in them, and people are still exploiting them. So this, one of the reasons that we learned this is that you guys can be really careful about the kind of code that you write. If that's the track that you go down, it's also helpful for, checking code and making sure that it's secure. So this will be very useful for you. You'll probably get a lot of buffer overflow stuff. And if you take more security classes at UNO, you'll certainly get more experience with buffer overflow. And the number one overall cause of security vulnerabilities is social engineering. So, be careful out there. So the most common form of this buffer overflow is what we've been looking at basically, which is this unchecked length on string input. So we have, we create these bounded character arrays on the stack, or we create buffers on the stack, and we will take an input and not check to make sure that it is a length that makes sense for what we have set up for it. And this can be referred to as stack smashing. Okay, so let's look at this implementation of gets. This is a Unix function. So what this does is it's going to take some string, some character array from input and store it, right? It's gonna store it in some buffer. So there's actually no way with this function to limit the number of characters that gets reads. It's not built into that. So we have some other we have problems that are very similar to this with some other libraries, str copy, str cat, scanf, fscanf, scanf. There are now secure versions of these, but very often, like, some of this insecure stuff still gets used or still exists on older codes. So yeah, you just don't want to be using these functions. And if you look at the man page of gets, gets is a very bad, if you ever see gets in any kind of source code you're looking at, you know that, like, that that program is like ripe for attack. Literally the man page says never use this function. Any questions so far? Okay, so let's, now that we've talked about gets a little bit and the way that that works, let's look at like a really simple code that uses it. So that we've got this little echo program that's just going to take some, I think we keep, I'm sorry, I just saw Russell's question. So I think the reason that we keep it in the code library is because if we took it out, it would potentially take a bunch of code, like, without meaning to, completely offline. So there's certainly some older systems that use this stuff. And if it got, I'm sorry, I can't think of like the word right now. I'm not decremented. My brain is
upstated.
So, I really think it's supposed to be a D, but it'll come to me at some point. Yeah, if we made this obsolete, then it would make a lot of code that maybe we aren't intending to take offline and unusable, and that could have like some pretty intense consequences. That is why I would guess we have not done that, because a lot of like systems, as you have seen, use C, a lot of like, you know, industrial control system stuff. So we don't want to go taking things off, even if they have these vulnerabilities. Some of them are not exposed to the internet. Some of them are not exposed to, even to user input or interactions. So making that unusable could cause some very, very, very big problems that we don't need to cause. It's just good now to not use these in our code, especially any code that's going to be accessible by like any user. There was like a long time where people just didn't even consider the possibility of like hackers or of users that are going to act in a way they're not supposed to act, right? So like some of this stuff like wasn't a problem for a while, and then people started being like, well, look at this, look at how easily this breaks, and look at the implications for this. So so now it's important not to use that, but it's also like good to know because this stuff is still out there. Like we talked about in the last slide, this is still a huge problem in security. So there's a lot of it that still exists, like, you know, in the wild. Okay, so if we look at this little bit of code, this is going to create like a really bitty character buffer of size 4. And we're going to use gets to get input from wherever our input's coming from, in this case, the standard input. And then we're going to use puts to send that output to wherever the output's supposed to go, and in this case, the standard output. So this is going to call echo. Whenever we call echo, we're going to type some string. In this instance here, we've typed, I should have counted these. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
I'm guessing there's 23.
We've got 24. It's 24. We've got this string that we put in, that's 24 characters, and it returns to us. It actually, it still works. It's returning to us, you know, this string that we typed in. So we're inputting a string and it's printing that string back out onto the screen, even though it's much bigger than that buffer, right? Now, if we were to put in 25 characters, then we get a segmentation fault. So let's look at why this is happening, right? Because you would think intuitively that you've got this little tiny character buffer, and so if you type anything before, you know, larger than four characters, actually larger than three characters, because and this is important to come into play with Attack Lab too, that any of your strings gets terminated with a null byte, so two zeros. So we actually need we actually would think that after three characters we would get that, but let's see what's actually happening. So, and we also talked about this a little bit before. So this is important to like look at when we're looking at our code. So remember how we talked about how at the beginning of functions we'll generally see a subtract, and at the end we'll see an add, and how that's because we are creating like our stack frame and making room on the stack for us to put stuff there. And then whenever we, right before we return, we have to like deallocate all that stuff that we've done and return that space, right? So that we can like reset back to that return address. So here we subtract text 18 from the stack pointer. So we create some space on the stack there, and then we move RSP to RDI. And just to illustrate, so we call echo from this call echo function down here, and this is the address that we would return to, right? So this should be our return address that gets pushed onto the stack, because our call is at 4006F1. The address that gets pushed onto the stack to return to will be 4006F6. So remember that. Great. Okay. Does anybody have any ideas as to why we might be moving RSP to RDI?
Why are we moving RSP to RDI?
So think about what we do. Think about our calling conventions, right? Think about what that first parameter is that gets used, that register that gets used when we pass in something, right? It's going to be RDI. So we need to be able to, we need to know that to be able to use those like passed in parameters. Okay. So here we have our little baby buffer, and that is going to be at the top of the stack there. So we've got this, we looked at it before and it was hex 18, right? We subtracted hex 18, this is in decimal, this is the decimal form. So it's actually 24. So we've got 24 bytes in this stack that we have allocated for this function. We've got that little extra, that extra space there that the compiler gives us. So we have our buffer, and we've got these 20 bytes of unused, or you know, kind of like wasted space here. So that is why, and we've got our return address right here, and then we have our stack, the rest of our stack frame for that older function that called echo. Okay, so now once we do call echo, we're going to go ahead and now you can see that return address that gets pushed onto the stack. So now you have this kind of diagram, this nice diagram of what things look like. This is the kind of stuff that you should be like visualizing in your head, or that you should think about when you're looking at these like Attack Lab functions. We have our little buffer right here. We've got these extra 20 bytes, and we know how big our buffer is because we subtracted we subtracted 24 bytes from RSP to make room for it. And then we have our return address right here. So let's see what happens when we actually send something into that function that is larger than that, you know, than that 4 bytes. So this is all ASCII. So, you know, this is still 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but it's going to be that hex ASCII code. So now we have this string, 0, 1, 2, 3, blah, 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 all the way to 2, and then terminated with this null byte here, this double 0, right? And then our return address is still there. So now we have written, and this is actually just 23. This is just like a 23 character input, right? So let's see. I think this next slide shows us what actually happens when we input those 24 bytes. This is 25 bytes. So this is when we got the segmentation fault. So now we've actually overwritten that return address, right? So the reason that we get a segmentation fault when we do this is that now we're trying to return to some place in memory that doesn't either have anything in it or that we aren't allowed to return to. And the compiler gives us that segmentation fault. So we have now changed like what the control flow of this program is doing just by putting in a string that's too big.
I have a question.
Yes.
To call to echo, call queue, does that like automatically, like, is it built in to add the return address to the stack? Because, like, I don't see anywhere in
yes.
that where that, like, that actually happens.
Yeah, so remember that is built into that call.
Okay, I think I asked about this last time. I just get confused when I don't see it explicitly.
No, that's totally understandable. That's a good question because that helps to reinforce that for everybody. Like, whenever that call builds in or has built into it that instruction that you are going to push whatever RIP is pointing to onto the stack. So whatever the instruction pointer or wherever the program counter currently is, the next instruction gets pushed onto the stack. So that it knows where to return to. Okay, so we looked at this segmentation fault example. Let's look at also that example where we put in 24 characters but didn't get a segmentation fault. So in this case, let's see, I think I have some chat stuff. Let me look at this.
That was just Michael talking about the question.
Oh, okay, cool. Gotcha. Okay, so here we have an example where we have overwritten everything that's in the buffer with, you know, whatever, it's junk really, and then we have the null terminator that overwrites that last piece of this return address, right? So now we're trying to return to 400600, and it just so happens, so this, like, change the return address to something that it wasn't supposed to return to, but for some reason our program still worked, and it turns out that this is what that address corresponds to in this program, this register TM clones. So it returns to, like, unrelated code, but it doesn't actually break our program, and it eventually does, you know, exit without a problem. That is, like, one other weird thing about this stuff is that you can sometimes do things, like, there can be a bug in your program or something broken in your program, and it's not immediately obvious because sometimes it'll just run correctly anyway, right? Okay, cool. Just, like, a little intro to code injection. So think about this, too. So we have... if we are able to figure out an address that would be beneficial for this code to return to. So if we know what our program looks like, and in this case, you're gonna try and get your attack lab program to return to things like, I think, touch 1, touch 2, touch 3, and then to, like, you know, run some code or do some other stuff. So if you know the address to things, you can try to overwrite that return address, little bit of exploit code that we've written. When you know what a RAM looks like, and this is like actually probably more benign, but whenever you can make a program return to some other point in its execution, some other, you just change the control flow that way, where it really becomes an issue, you run that code via like returns. And that is what you're going to be doing for Tech Lab, which is cool. This is cool. Like, and we have, you know, you'll be able to figure out what these addresses that you need to use might be. You also have things like OBJ dump that can help you with like actually like where things are and stuff like that. So that's the kind of stuff that you're going to be looking at least with those first couple of phases of a Tech Lab. Questions about any of that? Okay, cool. So this is just kind of a little overview about the kinds of things that can happen from buffer overflow. And they're super, super, super common. There's a reason that they like remain number one as far as like security vulnerabilities and exploited security vulnerabilities. Because also programmers just keep making the same mistakes. So I don't know why anybody would ever be using these library calls or library functions anymore, but they're still out there. There are some other like insecure things that still get done that I think we will go into a little bit like after this. And even though like we do things to make these, and we'll go over some of like the ways to mitigate these vulnerabilities, but you know, attackers have a lot of time. So yeah.
So I'm not sure if this is asked correctly, but why are those library calls?
Why are what?
Like those vulnerable, why are the vulnerable procedures kept around?
Okay, so this is like kind of like for this backward is what compatibility. Russell, exactly. That's what Russell asked too, and that is why. Like I said, a lot of these, a lot of this like systems code is used on like systems and some systems that are running some pretty old stuff, a lot of industrial control stuff and things like that. So if this stuff wasn't backwards compatible, we could create some real issues as far as breaking a lot of things that we really don't want to break. And just like, you know, shutting stuff down that like should not be shut down. I think that is the only reason it's for backwards compatibility. I don't think there's any other reason why we're still like, why we still have this stuff around and why it's still usable. So that is why. Well, we're just about done. I'll go through. We have like one little example of historical buffer overflow attack. So if you have heard of the Morris worm, this was the first internet-based malware. And it was spread via networks using buffer overflow exploits. It used several vulnerability spread. It did use gets, and then it used this older, this actually I think is an obsolete call, this like FingerD, which could reach out like across networks and talk to other devices and ask for a response from them. So that stuff would take input from users, and so this worm would crack their shell and spread itself. So once it became a system scan, of the computers to attack, and it took over an estimated 6,000 computers, which doesn't sound like that many, but in 1988, that was 10% of the internet. And there is, I think, a link to this little, yeah. So if you have this slide, there's a link to this article from June of 1989 that describes this attack. Here's a little photo of that. And this is the actual source code for that internet worm that has been copied onto this floppy disk and is in a museum, in the Computer History Museum. So this this malware was written by a grad student at Cornell named Robert Tappan Morris. He said that his goal was to measure the size of the internet, and it caused much faster than he anticipated, which was what caused major problems. This was the first felony conviction for something like this from the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1986. So this carries a federal charge, and a potentially long prison sentence. He kind of lucked out and was put on probation and fined $10,000. And led to the formation of CERT, which is the Computer Emergency Response something. But it is a federally funded research facility that that deals with this kind of attack stuff. And today he is a professor at MIT. So there we go. And here's, this is the worm birth. This is actually kind of interesting and useful to know, although you don't really need to know this for anything beyond your own interest. The worm is a program that can run by itself and can propagate a full working version of itself to other computers. A virus has to add itself to other programs. It can't run independently. Both are designed to spread on their own. I think that's the end of that one. Okay. Actually, this is a cool paper. So if you guys have, with all your extra time, if you want to read this, if you're interested in this like stack smashing stuff, this is like interesting and historically interesting too. It's called Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit. I think it's pretty readable. It was written by one of these like old school pseudonamed hackers, from the 90s. So I think it's kind of fun to read. I think that's it that I have. That's all I have for you guys today. Yeah, that's it. Any other questions?
Not here, thank you.
Cool. All right, guys. Well, we'll have help hours this week. So if you start, we're actually, I think, almost done grading Shell Lab stuff too. So that should get returned to you at some point this week, or you should know your final grade and you'll be able to. We can't return anything, obviously. We'll be able to look at the annotations we put in Autolab at some point. So that's coming soon, and we have help hours. So if you start with Attack Lab and you want help, we'll be there. Okay.
See ya. Thanks.
Hi.
I have a question.
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah. When is our final exam again? Is that in like
May? Our exam is scheduled for May 12th. So like I said at the beginning, I know people come in kind of late. We're still trying to figure out how we're gonna do our exam and if it's gonna look like a traditional exam for us. So stay tuned on that. Like as soon as we have more information on that, we will get that to you. We should actually be finished with our like traditional systems curriculum stuff in the next I would say 2 weeks, which puts us that's pretty early. Mm-hmm. Certainly before the end of the semester. So we're trying to figure out how to like utilize that time and also how to maybe like give you guys a final that works best for like the format of the class right now, rather than like trying to like proctor our traditional exam via Zoom, which just seems a little bit silly.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll let you know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm leaving for real. Bye.